Blog Talk Radio.
Every author has that one story that hits close to home for them. This is Yvonne Mason's.
This book is very personal to me.
The 50s has been idealized as a time of prosperity and growth for some. Those with mental and physical challenges often faced scorn and ridicule, and were destined to be left in so-called hospitals to wither and die. Dreamcatcher, Failure Was Never an Option, is the uplifting story of a man named Stan and his family's courage to defy the odds and succeed in an era where no merit was seen in the challenged.
It is the true story of my brother who was mentally and physically challenged. It is because of my brother Stan that I am a successful author.
Dreamcatcher, Failure Was Never an Option, is available through Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com now.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, it is Thursday night. I thought it was Wednesday night earlier in the day, but then that's where my head is. This is Off the Chain. I'm your host, Yvonne Mason, and of course that was a piece of shameless promotion, and that is a shameless promotion that I'm extremely, extremely proud of. That book, Dreamcatcher, Failure Was Never an Option, is the exact reason why I am so successful. It is a story of my brother Stan, who is mentally and physically challenged, born at a time when the challenged were literally tossed away like garbage. Only my mother didn't believe that. Like me, she believes that everyone has a purpose. And my brother has taught me more than I could ever teach him. To him, failure is never an option. If he wants something, he goes after it. If he doesn't get it, it doesn't matter because he succeeded anyway because he went after it. So, ladies and gentlemen, that segues into tonight's show, which we'll get into in a moment. But I have to tell you, I am so proud of this show. As y'all know, every day I do my little numbers and I jump up and down because I get so excited. My goal for this show was 15,000. We've surpassed that. Now we're working on 20,000. We're heard in over 53 countries. And on this show alone, our biggest supporter is the country of Australia, and I am so, so grateful. This morning, the numbers on this show, just Blog Talk Radio, Off the Chain, was 6,781 listeners. It blows my mind because we grow every day. Total, with all the podcasts that I put the show up on after it goes into archives, we are about 400 listeners away from 16,000. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this show's not even a year old, and we're already at almost 16,000 listeners. This tells me that this show is doing good work. So it's helping authors get out there. It's helping people with platforms get out there, helping business people, helping musicians. It's all about them. It's not about me. It's about them. And I am so honored that my guest contact me and say, Vaughn, when can I come back on the show? I have new guests contact me every day. Vaughn, I want to be on your show. It's their show, ladies and gentlemen. It's not my show. It's their show, and I am so, so honored that they want to come on. In fact, tonight's guest is not just an author, but she is an absolute amazing person. She reminds me a lot of my mother because my mother took on a project with my brother when she was told, don't, because you've got one other child, which was me, and you'll have more, which were my siblings, so just forget about Stan. He's not that important. Well, that's wrong, ladies and gentlemen. Every child has a purpose. Author Carlene Singleton is my guest tonight, and this is what her bio says. From prejudiced people to demonic activity, Carlene has seen firsthand the unfathomable love of God for all of his children. A native Mississippian, Carlene has lived the Christian faith in all of its reality. Along with her husband, Hamp, and their three children, the family fostered a rainbow of children, the last dozen being special needs. A nationally known advocate for all children, she has served on the board of Right to Life of Jackson and the founding boards of Adoption Ministries of Mississippi and the Mississippi Center for Public Policy. Carlene is a Bible teacher and advocate for special needs children on TV, radio, and in newspapers, and she speaks at conferences and human services events. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this show will be a a faith-based show. It will also talk about things that will probably be uncomfortable. That is the disclaimer for the night. But it is a show that I am proud to do. I am proud to have my guest here, and I hope and pray that each of you learn and listen with an open mind, because every child has a purpose and God has a plan. Welcome, Carlene. I am so glad you're here with me tonight.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, before we talk about this beautiful journey that you and your family have been on all these years, tell me a little bit about you. How did you get here? What brought you to wanting to foster children, especially children with special needs? Because having a foster child is difficult enough, but then to add a child that is disabled and challenged just puts another cog in that wheel. So was it something you wanted to do as a child? Was it something that you felt compelled to do because God led you in that direction? What brought you to this place?
I really was prepared in a very odd way. I wanted to be an attorney when I grew up. I wanted to be a lawyer for poor people. But if anybody had told me that I was going to spend my adult life taking care of sick and handicapped black babies, I'd have run as fast as I could in the other direction. That was the last kind of thing that I just never would have thought of that. But my mother brought me up, and all the women in the family were here in Jackson, and they all brought me up to be a Southern Belle. I was in the bicentennial as one of the bells. I was a homecoming queen. I was a cheerleader. I was in beauty pageants, blah, 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 blah. And I was always being observed by the women in the family as to how much potential, how much husband attaining potential I was going to have. But my mother had married a boy from New York, who had been in Hell's Kitchen during the Depression. And he moved down, he came down here for flight training, married my mother, went to war, came back, and I had all these women on one side that seemed to me to be perfectly useless people. They never did anything to help make the world better, and that always drove me crazy. I would get so agitated with them. But then on the other side, I had my father saying, "You don't let the boys win. You don't let the boys win. If you can outshoot a boy, outshoot him." There are guys that like that, and that's the kind of guy you want. And he having lived in Hell's Kitchen, he had lived in the tenements with no heat, no, certainly nothing to cool them, 10 families to a floor, one bathroom for 10 families. Each family had one room. It was a nightmare, just like everybody that had to live in the Lower East Side of Manhattan. But living there, he was friends with boys from every country in the world. And he learned very quickly, although he was Irish, and the Irish and the blacks really, really had a thing going, competing for jobs, and they fought all the time. But my daddy learned that you could not judge a person by what they look like, where they were from, or what the color of their skin was. And my daddy had long talks with me, and he never said, "Baby, I'm trying to counteract what your mother and her family are trying to teach you." He never said that, but that's what he did. And I never bought it. I never bought it. I had to do something that mattered in my life. I had to do something that counted. And I was an only child, and I was left alone a lot. So I was, when my friend, as is related in the book, went to the Catholic Church with her husband, even though she was not Catholic, the nuns got to know her. And I went to see her one day, and she had a foster baby. They didn't, all their foster homes were full at Catholic Charities. And she said, you know, you would be great at this. And I said, yeah, I probably would, because I had three children under 3 1/2. From there, it went to our applying to Catholic Charities. And they brought us a beautiful little white girl, and, you know, we cried and everything. And we're horrible. It was horrible to see her go. And I worried about the effects of those kinds of things on my children. I had no idea God was going to really use us. Our real ministry was going to be to special needs babies. And we kept some of them for as long as 3 years before we were even ready to say to Catholic Charities, this child will fit in a family now, because we figured out how to work around all of the problems and the illnesses and the things that doctors tell me, like, if you take this child home, he's going to die on you. He's going to die. It didn't matter. Once the seed was planted in my mind, it did not matter what doctors said or what nurses said or what anybody said. I was going to take that baby. And if it was God's will for that baby to die in my family with my little children there, I've always been very much a realist. And I was willing to do it. I wanted to do it. I wanted to make a difference. I had three beautiful children and a wonderful husband, and I wanted to do something with my life, and I wanted to stay home with my children. And even though it was frightening at first when we got special needs children, God was there at every moment. He was right at my elbow. Every moment, God was there right at my elbow, telling me things that I didn't have the knowledge to know about the baby. I had the Holy Spirit right there to tell me, this baby is nothing but a little boy with a bump between his eyes. He is a little boy. He looks strange because part of his brain is caught outside his head. But he's just a little boy that needs a mother and daddy, and will really love having sisters and brothers. And I picked the first handicapped baby I picked up from Catholic Charities. Looked like he had two noses, one on top of the other, and I was scared to death. But on the way home, God told me what I just said, and by the time I got home with him, before I got home with him, I was fine with him. I was fine with him, and God healed him, healed his sight, healed all his reflexes, healed his brain, and it was wonderful. And the way God did everything was the best possible way. When he healed that baby, when we got the baby, he had no reflexes. His eyes rolled around in his head sometimes, and He couldn't do anything, didn't do anything except eat and cry. But on Thanksgiving Day, my husband called to me to come into the living room, and he said, Caleb is looking at me. Caleb is looking at me. My husband had just lit a cigarette, and he was looking at the light. And I walked into the living room and walked up to Caleb, who was in a little baby seat like we had back then, and he watched me. His eyes were together. He was looking at me. He watched me walk up to him and looked up at me, and when I got to him, he smiled.
Wow.
Within 2 weeks, every symptom of brain damage was gone. Every one. And we had us a rambunctious, happy, that child, he came to visit us when he was 18 and stayed with us. We took him to another state where they have a lot of multiple adoption families. And those states have a lot of services for those kids. He had the bump removed when he was 4. when the neurosurgeon here told me, don't you dare, she was really ugly. She said, don't you even think about that, the idea. She said, you could finish his brain off if you did that. So I didn't ask about it anymore, but out where we took him, the parents asked. They did the surgery when he was about 4, and now he's got a scar that you can see a little bit of the scar close to his eyebrow, where he was, they cut that big arc across the top of your head and peel your face down.
Right.
And when they did that, they saw that there was no brain in that encephalocele, and that's what encephalocele means. It means brain caught outside. There was no brain in there. There was some spinal fluid, a couple of fragments of bone. But in addition, there was a flat place right on the front of the brain. It was flat. And it was just like God had just taken his finger and pushed the brain back and healed it. Because if the front of your brain is not working, your eyes can't work, because they've got to have a connection all the way to the back of your brain, to your retinas, for you to be able to see. And they got out there, they all... I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's okay. It's like my mother said when they told her that my brother would never be functional because he had encephalitis,
oh, yeah,
and it destroyed the part of his brain for coordination and speech. And what my mother said was basically the same thing that happened with your little Caleb. The brain was retrained to function. It's like a muscle. It is a muscle. And if a muscle is not exercised, it atrophies. And y'all had the wherewithal and the love to help him retrain that brain.
Well, let me tell you this. I agree with you. A lot of it is teaching the brain how to adapt. But that's not the case with Caleb. We didn't have him but about 4 to 6 weeks before this happened. We had done no physical therapy on him. We'd never had a baby that physical therapy was needed. He was our first special needs baby. We didn't do anything unusual for him. Nothing. God did every bit of it. And one reason of the myriad reasons that I probably will never know about till I get to heaven, is because God knew that I was not a person. I'm not a gambler.
Right.
You will not ever get me to gamble one penny of my money, my safety, my children's health. No, I'm not a gambler. And I'm sorry, I forget why I said that. I don't take chances. And I took that baby and expected him to get very big and then die. That was the prognosis. He would get very big and heavy very quickly. Both of his parents were over 6 feet tall, and he would get very big very quickly, and then he would just die. But God just intervened himself, because there was no time for anything to retrain itself. It was literally weeks between his eyes looking in different directions and seeing nothing to coming together and looking up at me and smiling. His pupils were always unequal. They were never equal in those first, say, 6 weeks. And they were not equal for about another week. But then, after 2 weeks, his pupils were equal. He was reaching out for toys. He was trying to roll over. God had healed him. God, I believe that was the finger of God, I believe, just pushed the brain back out of that encephalocele and just caused everything to hook up and be exactly like it's supposed to be.
So
that
what
boy
does
has
that young,
no handicaps at all.
What does he do now? You said he came to see you when he was 18. Did he
go
on to college?
No. I don't know where he is now. I don't know where he is. Well, I know what state he's in. But we do not keep up with the babies unless the family wants to. And that family did want to, and we saw him several times when we went to take other handicapped babies to that part of the country. But he got into some trouble that just devastated me. And I have not wanted it. Now his parents had trouble with every child they had adopted. They had about 12 or 13, and every cop in their city knew the names of almost all of their kids. Those kids reverted to their genetic code, I guess, when they got to be teenagers and on into young adulthood and even middle age. Some of them still were just really messed up. So a lot of them outgrew it. They finally saw what their adoptive parents had been telling them was true, and I stopped checking because I couldn't handle knowing the baby, the happy, bright-eyed little boy that I had known that would just stop old white ladies in their tracks in the grocery store with that big grin. They would have been whispering about me, thinking I was married to a black man back in the 70s, no, the 80s. We got him, I think, in 1980, through the 80s and 90s. But invariably, if I left him exposed to people for very long, like if I stepped away from the grocery cart for a minute, where I could, you know, just a couple of feet to get something off a shelf, whoever had been following us, just soaking up everything they could to tell their friends what they saw in the grocery store, they would stop and look at him, and they would be cooing and making funny faces at him and laughing at him while he was laughing at them, and they would say, "Well, you really are an adorable little boy. You really are just the cutest little thing." And then when I stepped back to the grocery cart, then they would ask me how I came to have that baby, and I'd tell them. Then they'd ask me what was wrong with his nose, why he had this big bump over his nose, and I would tell them that. So I wanted God to take the bump, but he didn't. And now I realize why. He knew that where he was going, he was going to have surgery and it would be removed. But he also knew that as long as he had that bump, people would be asking me about him. And I learned very quickly how to tell people about God and his babies without any hesitation. Those babies went everywhere with us and with me when the children were in school. Everybody at the PTA meetings, everybody at the conferences, everybody at the parties, everybody at the Brownie and Girl Scout troop, Boy Scout troop things, I had a baby with me. So it was, God just worked everything out perfectly. And my ignorance really was probably his best tool, because I didn't know. I never knew what God would do.
And you didn't know what you didn't know, which was probably also a blessing, because you had no preconceived ideas about how things were going to go or what was going to happen or how it was even going to happen.
A funny thing about that, I took these babies to my pediatrician that I had used with them, or that I was using with them, and I asked him if he would write the foreword for the book, and he did. And when he sent me the foreword to the book, not only did he say, "I saw these miracles, the things in this book are true," he said those words. He also said that it was his job to provide the conventional wisdom at the time, you know, about medicine. The second baby, handicapped baby, he examined him and he looked at me and shook his head and he said, "Carlene," he said, "this is not Caleb." He said, "there's nobody in there." But there was. But what he put in the foreword was, I even though it was my job to give her the conventional medical wisdom at the time, I tried never to quash Carlene's optimism. And when I read that, I just burst out laughing. I laughed and laughed and laughed, and I said to my husband, I said, "Read this. Bob thought I was optimistic." I expect, if a doctor told me this baby's going to die on you, I thought this baby's going to die on me. I never expected anything else. But he healed Caleb completely. The next baby was a failure to thrive baby, a little black boy that weighed 6.5 pounds when he was 9 months old.
Whoa.
He couldn't keep food down because his lungs were rebuilding from being intubated for months. He was born at 28 weeks. And he had scars literally all over his body. And for a solid year, that baby lay in a fetal position and never acknowledged anything. Then, one day, after us having, I had a physical therapist at the University Medical Center that I would take the babies to, starting with him, and we would roll him on a ball to try to teach him to lift his head. My husband made two pieces of white poster board stand up, and we would put him in between those two pieces of white poster board on his tummy on a quilt on the floor, and we'd put toys right up in front of him. This is after we had discovered after God restored his sight. There's so much to tell. It's hard to be verbal about it. He was born so early and spent all his whole babyhood until I got him when he was 9 months old and weighed 6.5 pounds. He had been in the hospital all that time. And two heads of the Department of Ophthalmology had examined him and said, well, you know, we know that pouring oxygen to this baby is going to destroy his retinas. He's going to be blind. I mean, we know that. But they checked his eyes and checked his eyes and checked his eyes. And from the very beginning, he was blind. They said he was born so early, and back then they believed brain development stopped at a certain point after birth.
Uh-huh.
And so when he started following my husband's cigarette lighter, we discovered after about a year that he could see. And I think he just was born so prematurely and had so little stimulation in the hospital, and everything they did to him hurt. He had big scars down his back from heat monitors, to something to do with keeping him warm. He had lived under a bright light. He had cut downs for IVs all over him, even in his head. They had had to cut down and try to find veins with blood in them to try to give him IV fluids. And I think he just shut the world out, and his brain just didn't develop, just like a person who is so stressed out they can't learn. That's
right,
the principle that I learned from the babies. Yeah, well, if a child is in pain or frightened, they are not going to learn anything.
No.
So when I took him to the hospital the first time after he had been looking at things, he would look and then he wouldn't. He would look and then he wouldn't. But when I took him back to the hospital, to the high-risk clinic, the time that I knew he could see, he wouldn't follow my keys for anything. He wouldn't look at anything. And the doctors and nurses were all patting me and hugging me, and, you know, and I could just hear their thoughts. Bless her heart. She's so ignorant. She doesn't realize that all the oxygen destroyed his retinas. Well, the next time we went up there, about 6 weeks later, he followed everything. And they were calling doctors from all over the hospital to come and see this baby that they had all taken care of, that was now no longer blind, and he was reaching out for things. Well, I'm sorry, he wasn't reaching out for things then. That came later. And the story about how he reached out for a toy for the first time, I really don't want to spoil for anybody that wants to read the book, because that was one of the most precious, powerful things I have ever seen. And what God showed me when he did it just opened my eyes to a whole new dimension of spiritual understanding. But he did not heal his brain completely, but he did learn to sit up. He learned to roll around on the floor. He learned to sit in a corner chair and feed himself, which I thought was going to take probably another year just to teach him to hold the spoon. He threw the spoon twice, and then I put some food on it and put it up to his mouth. And he got to where, and he put it in his mouth, and he could only take a little bit at a time. And he threw up a lot. He threw up everywhere. Everywhere I went, he threw up. I took a dozen cloth diapers everywhere I went, and a baby receiving blanket or two, because everywhere I went, he was throwing up because his body could not deal with the food. I had to give him medium chain triglyceride oil. I've got this liquid brewer's yeast. Let me back up a little bit. I always tasted food before I gave it to a baby. I tested medicine myself before I gave it to a baby, because they will tell you, oh, this doesn't burn. This doesn't taste bad. And it's for children, and you believe what they tell you, but it's not true. And so I always tested everything. Well, I got this liquid, enzymatically predigested brewer's yeast, you know, for your nervous system.
Right.
Well, I touched my tongue to the spoon that I poured it out. I poured out some and touched my tongue to it, and it tasted like distilled dead cats. That's what it tasted like. I mean, that was the nastiest stuff I ever touched with my tongue in my life. Well, I went in there and I just touched it to his tongue. No reaction. I said, okay, here's a big part of the problem, guys. Matthew can't taste. That's one reason he's not trying to learn to eat. I found out several things. He couldn't taste. He had no appetite. And there was one other thing that meant he needed, zinc. He needed zinc. All the doctors agreed, but they were all afraid to prescribe it because you don't know how much zinc a person needs. You just know they have it. So I called doctors in other states, found a doctor that was experimenting with children with Down syndrome and zinc. And I got his dosage per pound, and I cut that into 1/4. I gave him 1/4 zinc that this doctor was using, and prayed every time I gave it to him it wouldn't hurt him. Within about a month or two, he had a preference for baby vanilla puddings.
Wow.
He would start to cry when I took it away. He had never shown the first interest in having anything put in his mouth unless his tummy was hurting because he was hungry or thirsty. And that's how he learned to start feeding himself. I found out that he needed zinc. I, thank God, gave him a small enough dose, but it helped. And it wasn't but a couple of months of that he started eating. And so we got him a corner chair where he could sit up and be braced on both sides. I don't know if you know what a corner chair is.
Yeah.
I've never heard of it. Okay, well, it helps a baby sit up straight that has trouble balancing. It was no time before he was feeding himself in that corner chair. It wasn't pretty, but he was feeding himself. He learned to scoot around in a walker. He learned to obey commands like, Matthew, no, don't touch that again. When he went to uproot a plant out of one of the pots on the back porch, he learned how to try to comb his hair. And the last thing he learned how to do was laugh.
Wow.
And my son had an ability with babies that absolutely was God-given. My son could make a baby smile that had never smiled before in their life. And the babies, they just loved John. They just loved him. And John was trying to stand on his hands in the living room, and Matthew started making this strange little noise. I'd never heard it before. And I went over and looked at his face, and it didn't look like he was laughing. But he was watching John, and every time John stood on his hands and put his feet in the air, Matthew would make this strange, wry little sound, and he had this weird, contorted look on his face, but he was laughing. He was laughing at John. I could go on all night. You need to stop me.
No, we have one more to talk about. We have Baby Ben to talk about.
Okay. Yes, Baby Ben. I got a call from a social worker saying how Baby Ben had been taken into custody, and they had put him in a group home because that's the only place they had to put him. And they said he was just not responsive to anything. And his body temperature was so cold, they were afraid he was going to die. His brain stem was damaged. And that it maintains your body temperature, keeps your heart beating, keeps you breathing. It's your vital signs, part of your brain. Uh-huh. And he... They brought him down here. I had one baby brought to me with a police escort, with a highway patrol escort. They were so afraid he was going to die before they could get him out of their county and into my county and into my arms so that it wouldn't be their fault.
Wow.
I had Ben was brought with a nurse. Had another baby brought with a nurse. When I got, we picked, my husband and I picked Ben up at Catholic Charities, and I took one look at him, and he was adorable. He was so cute. He looked so much like Micah, the baby we had that couldn't sleep. And they were telling me that they had ridden the whole way in the Mississippi summer with the windows down and the air off because he was so cold. But you don't know. If you haven't been there, you don't know. First thing I did was open his diaper bag and take out every stitch of clothes he had and put them on him. Then I wrapped him in a couple of blankets. They said he wouldn't eat. They had a bottle, but he wouldn't suck it. I looked at it, and it was really, really thick. So I went in the bathroom. I poured part of it out, put real warm water in it, shook it up, took it to the coffee machine, put two packets of sugar in there, shook that all up, dripped some on his lips, and he started drinking. So I got a bottle into him. He was small, and it was just a 4-ounce bottle. But I got a bottle into him, and then I took him straight to my pediatrician, which I always did, and he took one look at him and thought there was something horrible. I mean, not that it was just brain damage, but that he was sick. And he took his temperature, and it was like 91. And he said, you need to go straight to the Baptist Hospital, go straight upstairs to the fourth floor. Tell them you're admitting him downstairs and for them to take him immediately and start doing tests on him. My husband checked us in downstairs. I took him straight up to them, and I told the nurse, I said, I can't even tell if he's breathing. She snatched him out of my hands. They put him under a heat lamp. His body temperature went up about a fourth of a degree after hours. The pediatrician came and did a spinal tap. They put him in ICU for a week. It was the first only time I ever picked a baby up that I couldn't take him home with me. But after a week, they had decided it's his brain. His brain is just barely chugging along. And
wow.
Everybody warned me, this baby is probably going to die on you. That baby got so attached to my son that when he was about 6 or 8 months old, he still didn't do anything. He was like a newborn. But Maggie Wade, she's the local person to come out and do the thing for children up for adoption, and she'd been to my house before. And John was out of town. My son, he was between Air National Guard and college. And he was out of town. Well, he came in town right while I was trying to get him to open his eyes. I was combing his hair when John came in. The only thing Ben really, really hated beside the tape holding the NG tube that I put down into his stomach through his nose to feed him was having his hair combed. He really got riled up if you tried to comb his afro. He did not appreciate that. I said, I hate to do this to you, honey, but you've got to open your eyes. And I started combing his hair. He kind of moved around a little bit, but he didn't open his eyes. John called Mother. His eyes flew open. He heard John.
Wow.
We tried and tried to get that. John took him, and he would look up at John and just stare into John's eyes, and he was blind. The baby was blind. He would just, his eyes would be just focused on where that sound was coming from. And I had a little white boy with no brain at the same time. It's the only time that ever happened. That was a very special, almost lethal experience for me. I just about didn't make it. But I went to check on Daniel, the little white boy, and they kept trying to get Ben to keep his eyes open with Maggie holding him. And John would get his eyes open and get him all interested in John, and then John would hand him to Maggie. Those eyes would slam shut. So I didn't know what they had. They were leaving by the time I got there, and when I came back out, and I didn't. They never showed the foster families. That was just a policy that they never showed us.
Right.
They showed my son, my 18-year-old son, holding Ben, talking to him, and Ben looking at him like he thought he had hung the moon.
Wow.
But I was also going to tell you that I really became convinced that Ben was an angel. My father lived with us upstairs, and he had throat cancer, and he was over it for a time, but he died while we had Ben. And I really felt that I could sit down, wrap Ben and me in a comforter to try to warm him up, and just rock him. And the most incredible peace would come over me. I adored my father. I just adored him. He was all I had, really, growing up. My mother was not a nurturing mother at all. And I was so torn. Ben was clearly dying. My daddy was clearly dying. And at one point, I had one of them on one floor of the hospital and one of them two floors down in the hospital in ICU. Ben was in ICU, and Daddy was on the cancer floor. I just stood in the elevator praying, God, please don't take both of them. Please don't take them both away from me. Please don't. But it turned out that they had to put Ben in an observation room across from the nurse's station because I couldn't be there all the time. I had the white boy at home who really was normal except that his brain was not developing, and he had to have a shot at one point, which is in the book. So my children were well able to take care of him. They were teenagers then. My daughter had already saved a child's life twice whose tracheostomy had gotten stopped up, but I found that people would be standing there at the window looking at him, and they had to be where the nurses could see him. So he was way up on display, kind of in an off room where they kept the hospital puppet Bernard that went around and visited the children, and he was just lying there. That's all Ben ever did, was just lie there. And he was propped up on pillows because his gut had shut down, and it was swelling, and it was pushing up against his lungs and his stomach. And he was in really bad shape. And I would come and I got to where quickly I would speak to the person standing there looking at him, because enough had told me I was sitting wherever they were waiting with their loved one or, you know, staying overnight or whatever. And I just got to thinking about baby Ben, and I just had to come up here and see how he was doing. And people would ask me when I got on the elevators, are you baby Ben's mother? And I'd say, well, yes, I am. And they'd say, you know, there's just something about him. I'm just drawn to go up and just look at him. I go up there and just stand there and stare at him, and I don't know why. But I'm not talking about two or three people. I'm talking about several dozen.
Wow.
Who literally, I all but adopted him while he was in the hospital. And he never opened his eyes and looked at them because he couldn't see them, but he never opened his eyes. He never moved. Ben had virtually no control over his body at all. And because he had no upper brain to tell his body what to do. That's
right.
Why when his brain started to go, his intestinal tract shut down. And the only way that I could get any elimination out of him was to give him enemas. And that's described in the book, and it was no big deal the way I did it, but everybody in the family was grossed out about it by my younger daughter, Laura, who became a police dispatcher, and Ben and me. You know, it didn't bother any of the three of us, but the others just, you know, clutched their hearts and said, don't do that in here. Go do that in the bedroom. But we went to take, no, I'm not going to tell you that, because if anybody buys the book, I don't want to ruin that for them.
Before we run out of time, ladies and gentlemen, the name of Carlene's book is We Carry Gold. And real quick, Carlene, if you don't mind, I want to read the synopsis because this is a perfect synopsis.
Okay.
And it goes like this, ladies and gentlemen. That afternoon, a call came from a social worker. A little black boy needed a foster home. He was 11 months old and had only half of his brain. He was spastic, quadriplegic, blind, couldn't eat, had breathing problems, and would probably die soon. As I stood there listening to her describe the poor child, I was thinking, no, please, Lord, not another one so hard, not so soon. Oh, Lord, I don't want to, I don't want to. We Carry Gold relates the journey of one family in the exploration of faith, disability, race relations, and many more social issues. Relive Carlene's experiences as she and her family embark on the challenge of providing foster care to special needs children. Her memories provide deep thought and introspection. And I'm going to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, if you've never been around a special needs child or you've never had a special needs child, it takes a special person to be able to accept and love and care for a special needs person they've given birth to. But for Carlene to take these children into her home and love them unconditionally, and her family to love them unconditionally and to do things for them that they didn't even have done for them in group homes or in hospitals or in doctor's offices, this woman has been touched by a hand that is mightier than any of ours.
Amen. Do you have time for me to tell you one more little short thing?
Yes, ma'am, I do.
We had been without a baby for about 6 months, and that was just such an unusual thing for us. John had made the comment, we need another baby around here. You know, where are the babies? And I was saying to God when I was praying, Lord, I've got all these doctors. I know all these specialists. I've got physical therapists. I've got all these toys. I've got all these special things, you know, like the ball to roll them on. Lord, I know there are children out there that need that care. Surely you must need me. And I heard in the spirit, I heard the Lord laugh. And he said, I don't need you. He said, I could take a teenager off the street that didn't even have any education and make her able to do what you do. I don't need you. I picked you, but I don't need you. And I started laughing. And I thought, how stupid could I be? I mean, I'm constantly shocked at how dumb I am. And that was the truth. And that's I was an only child. I didn't even know how to pick up my own children at first.
But God does his wonders to perform are just, we don't understand the how, when, where, what. But if we pay attention and we listen and we live our faith, a way is always provided.
I've got journal entries from my prayer journals throughout the book. In every child's chapter, there are journal entries. Sometimes they're about the baby, sometimes they're not. But living that life put me on third base. I didn't get on third base by myself, but it put me and my family on third base. And I realized things, I saw things were made clear to me because God had called me to do that particular thing. Anybody that reads this book is absolutely blown away by the things God did for the babies and for me. And it was not easy. It's like I say in the book somewhere, I think toward the beginning, God is like a golden thread running through the rough, brown, coarse burlap of our lives. But as long as we've got that thread, that one thread of gold, going through that awful day where all the baby does is spit up, all the baby does is scream, the baby won't eat, the children are fussing, my husband comes home in a bad mood. Even those days, that gold thread is there. And that gold is so powerful in the midst of all that burlap that he will manifest himself to us. But you honestly, I hate to say this, but it's the truth, Yvonne, and I wish it weren't the truth. If you are not in a sacrificial place, a place that is costing you your very life day by day, you're not doing what you would enjoy doing. You are doing what you know God wants you to do and what God makes you want to do. You're not going to see these things.
No,
the only reason I saw and learned and became so knowledgeable about God and his word and how he works was purely through the babies that he brought to me and then taught me how to take care of and explained enough to me so that I would understand and could keep going. And I hate to say that because so many believers today are Christians and they feel like they both have to go to work and they don't have time for other people. They write a check to send it off. Isaiah 58 does not say, build places for the poor and cram them all in there. It says, bring the homeless poor into your home. Uh-huh. That's the original. That's the original Hebrew. Bring them into the house. Well, there was no house or the home. There was no place, no home for people like that. There were not even any hospitals.
Uh-uh.
They had to, it means bring them home and feed them and take care of them and do all that you can for them. So I really appreciate you letting me talk. I'm sure you had some wonderful questions, and I'm sorry.
Because, like I said, that is why I call the show Off the Chain, Carlene, because even though I have notes, if we don't get to them, it's no big deal, because I allow the conversation to go where it will. That is Johnny Carson taught me well. Johnny Carson had notes, but more times than not, his conversations with his guests just went where it would. And
yeah.
I have personally learned so much, and it has deepened my faith that I already had that was very, very deep, because I believe God has a plan for all of us, and I believe that God has a plan for us. And
yeah,
it does.
He does.
And I believe that he has a plan for every child that's born. And so when we destroy
Absolutely.
That child, we destroy a piece of our fabric. We destroy a piece of our future. So what you have done is you have kept that tapestry together by being a mother to these children who had no one.
That's right. They were, but nobody in their right mind would have given babies that sick to a woman who was not a nurse, who didn't have any medical training except what I got with my parents and my son who were all sickly, but nothing terrible. And I'm sorry, my mind went blank.
That's okay. Because what I want you to do is tell people where you can be found and give the name of your book again. And can it be bought on Amazon?
It can be bought on Amazon. It can. Let me see.
And where can you be found in case someone wants to hook up with you and become a friend with you and learn more about you?
I am on Facebook, Carlene Singleton. And if you type, well, if you type Carlene Singleton, you'll probably get me. If you type Carlene Singleton, We Carry Gold, you'll get my book at Amazon. And I'm looking here. A friend made me some cards. I'm not real educated on the computer, but on Facebook yet. I can't see this. Laura, can you read that? You read this. This is wait.
Read it to her.
It's HTTP. /GOO.GL/JBZPNU, and the ZPN in the last part is capitalized.
Okay.
I'm going to make her an easier one soon. I'm going to do her a better one than this real soon. I've never seen this before.
She needs one that just says Carlene Singleton. There you go. So, ladies and gentlemen, this is what you do. If you'll type in Carlene Singleton on Facebook, you'll get her. Go to Amazon and look up Carlene Singleton, We Carry Gold. And I'm going to tell you, it will change your life forever. Tomorrow night.
If you like.
Go ahead.
If you like, I'll give you my email address.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, it's Carlene, C-A-R-L-E-N-E, M as in mother, Singleton, S-I-N-G-L-E-T-O-N, all lowercase, @gmail.com.
So, ladies and gentlemen, contact her. And if you have a child that's disabled and you want some comfort, some words of encouragement, I'm sure Carlene will be happy to help you get through this, because we all need it. None of us are an island. Tomorrow night, we will have, at 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, we have author Judy Pence. And then on Saturday night at 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, I'm still on Eastern Standard Time, not daylight time, we have filmmaker Dee McCulley. And ladies and gentlemen, it's like I said, Carlene had no idea what her dream would be. Her idea was for it to be something else, but yet she allowed God to give her a dream, and it's been fulfilled many times over. Unless you've been in a position to deal with a child who is unique, you have no idea how strong a woman it takes for that. I admire you, Carlene, like you would not believe. You were right up there with my mother, because my mother, I'm serious,
well,
because
it,
my
it
mother.
Was God. It, no, Jeremiah
and,
went
and
through
she
a period where. Jeremiah tried not to tell the people. He just got so worn out with it. But he said it was like fire in my bones. I had to do it. I really relate.
So, ladies and gentlemen, we are running. And now, Carlene, when the show goes dark, don't hang up, because I got some other things to tell you. So just hang in there. But I want to thank you for sharing your story and for inspiring me and encouraging me in ways that you have no idea, and for doing what you do. And I agree, God gets all the glory, because only God could have given you the strength to do that. That
oh,
was
absolutely.
Not something you could have done without it. So, ladies and gentlemen, tomorrow night at 8 o'clock, join us with Judy Pence, who is an author. She's got some interesting books that we're going to talk about. And when you're around your children, give them a big fat hug and kiss and encourage them to succeed, because they are our future. They all have a purpose. Remember that. Any child you see out there has a purpose. So with that, I will say, don't be that person that at the end of your day said shoulda, woulda, coulda. Make your dream real and help your children make their dream real. And until tomorrow night, this is Yvonne with Off the Chain. We say good night. Now, Carlene, we are off the air, but everything I say now will still go up in the archives. But I wanted to let you know that when we get off the phone and I shut the show down and it goes up into archives, when it gets up there, I'm going to post it on Facebook and I'm going to tag you in it. And you can take that show and promote it any way you want to. That's my gift to you. You can put it on your anywhere. Give it to your friends, whatever. Then tomorrow, when I put up the podcast, I will do the same thing. Once the podcasts are uploaded, I'll put it on Facebook and tag you and say the show is up on Spreaker, the show is up on SoundCloud, et cetera, et cetera. Take that and run with it. Share it. Let's get your story out there.
Yes, I really have a burden to do that. I want, there's so many. I asked a pediatrician the other day who's retired, if the numbers of babies being born with severe birth defects had gone down any, and he said no. He said there are just so many more.
Yes.
He said there's so many handicapped babies being born, and it's of course all the stuff that their mothers are putting in the bodies.
Yep. I agree.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it. And I'm so glad to have found out that, I'm so glad that God worked it out, that that you had a brother that that made you able to just totally relate to everything that I was saying.
Oh, absolutely. Because
that was a real blessing.
He has taught me so much. He taught me more than I could ever teach him. The man is. He is just over the moon amazing.
That
and
is
what
so
I would
wonderful.
Like, it is. I thank God for him every night. What I would like to do is maybe bring you back towards the end of the year, and let's talk some more. Because you've got a whole lot
because
more to say, and a
there's
whole lot
so
more
much
to
I didn't tell you.
So if I
so
brought you
much
back,
I didn't
Nate,
tell you.
So if I bring you back maybe sometime in November, we can continue this conversation and just keep getting you out there.
Okay, that would be great. The more people that hear that God is with every special needs child, and that if His people will stop looking at themselves and start looking around them. The whole world would change. The entire world would just be a different place.
I agree. So let's continue this in November, my friend. Thank you, darling. I appreciate you so much. And see, you were worried that you wouldn't fit my criteria.
Yes, I was. That was not fair. You should have told me about your brother.
I don't tell everything I know. I like to keep a few surprises. And I
want
that
was a big surprise to me.
And I want people to be at ease when they come on my show, because when you think about it, it's just you and I having a conversation.
Yeah.
And sharing experiences and journeys and ideas and getting to know one another.
Yeah. You know, I've been interviewed in the radio station and over the phone, and you're the best interviewer that I've ever had.
Thank you. You made my day.
By far the best interviewer. I had one, actually I knew the man from Right to Life. I had me on his talk radio show, and he started off with, Carlene, why don't you think we hear more about foster parents?
That's
not
the way to start it.
I said, I don't know, Jim. I guess because we're all busy. I mean, what are you going to say to that? I don't know why people don't know about foster parents. Everybody that knows me knows about foster parents.
it was just stupid. He didn't make any effort at all to give me a chance to say anything important.
Well, I think what it is, Carlene, is most people, and I found this true throughout my entire life, because dealing with Stanley when he was little, most people are not comfortable with something that is out of the ordinary. And children that are unique, I choose to call them unique because they are unique. They are a blessing. They have their own niche. People don't, it's uncomfortable to talk about what's wrong with them, because when someone does that, then one has to face their own frailties, and God forbid that we understand that we have frailties and failings and challenges. I am left-handed in a right-handed world. I stutter when I get tired. I do like I did when I picked up the phone. I called you Charlene, knowing your name was Carlene. I transpose my letters. I transpose numbers. But I am still a good
person. You're making me feel so much better. I'm left-handed, too.
Well, see, but see,
and
we're,
all the other we, stuff.
But we are the most intelligent people out there. Because we think with the right side of our brain. So there
I'm
you
sure
go.
You're right. I'm sure you're right.
So when people cannot accept their own shortcomings, it's hard to talk, not at someone, but with someone, about someone else's uniqueness. Because God forbid, we should go and walk that path. And we may have to walk that path one day. So it would stand to reason that we would want to be educated about it.
Now, people want to block it out. They want to block it out, and they're afraid of it. They're afraid I never had anybody help me with the babies, except on very rare occasions. And it was because they said they were afraid that something would happen and they wouldn't know what to do. And no matter how I assured them, if you just let me put him here on this quilt with some toys, and let me go to the grocery store, I'll be back in less than an hour. I'll do anything else for you, but I can't do that. I'm scared. I'm scared.
And it's because it's false evidence that appears real. Then we're not sure of their own abilities to handle an emergency. Well, if it's an emergency and you don't know what to do, you pick up the phone and call 911, and you very logically explain what's going on, and you deal with it.
Yeah.
It's not rocket science. If you had left a baby that's quote-unquote normal while you ran to the grocery store, they would not have that fear, which is false evidence that appears real.
Yeah.
So it's that
You're
unknown
right.
factor, yeah, that scares
mm-hmm.
people
The
off.
Unknown, yeah.
My husband's
yeah,
in a scooter. My husband's 81 years old, and he is in a scooter. He hasn't been able to walk for several years. Well, when we're out in public, I have wee ones that will watch him, and they'll stare at him, and they'll watch him, and the parents try to drag him off. I said, no, stop.
What?
I said, the child
They'll try
wants,
to drag
no.
him off?
Yeah, they don't want the – no, they try to drag the children off because they don't want the children staring at my husband. But I tell the parents, stop just a minute. Your child wants to be educated. They don't understand why a grown man is on a scooter, because grown-ups mm-hmm. don't do that. Grown-ups are supposed to walk. I said, so please
yeah.
let me educate that child. That's all they want to know is why. And it's okay
yeah.
for them to ask why. I want them to know
yeah.
why. And when I tell them, I said, when you were little and you couldn't walk, your mommy and daddy put you in a stroller so you could get around. I said, my husband can't walk anymore because his legs quit working. So he has to be in this scooter so he can go out and go to the grocery store and go to movies and go to the doctor and go out to eat and all the things that he likes to do. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's all they wanted to know.
Yeah.
And they were fine with it.
Yeah.
But when you don't educate a child and you just drag them off and say, oh, don't ask the question, that's wrong. Ask the question.
I totally agree with you.
And that's
totally
my soapbox for tonight.
Well, I hope that you will get a copy of the book and read all
of it. Oh, absolutely.
I'm
going to send it to my mother.
You
because
will.
Because my mother.
Oh, she'll love it, too.
She'll absolutely love it.
There's funny stuff in there that will make you laugh until you hurt. There's some things in there that will make you cry. I got a note. I got lots of notes and letters from people when I was in the Clarion Ledger with the first book. Didn't hear anything from anybody with the second book. But with the first book, I got a note from a lady that said, you took me through every emotion I have. She said, I laughed, I cried, I mourned, I was just frantic, I was sad. She said, just every feeling that I've ever had in my life, I had reading that book. But that's because it's life. The daughter you were talking to, she got pregnant when she was 18. We were devastated. We were just heartbroken. And she had been going with this boy that I just loved, but they were teenagers, and they got caught. My husband made the point when Laura was in church with us after the church had the church really handled it very well. I won't go into what they did, but they handled it very well. It was not just glossed over. There was no blame put. There was just restoration for her and repentance for her. And I was so grateful for the way the church handled it. But it was such a disappointment. And such a concern and fear for that child, because there was no way in the world we were going to make her give up her baby. I would never do that to my child.
No.
And she wanted the baby, but we didn't try to force her to marry the boy, because the boy was just he was just not our little daughter's a spitfire, and I mean she had him on his knees all the time. She just ragging on him and fussing at him. And I asked him one time, why do you let her treat you like that? And he said, I don't know. Now he's got another woman that he's married to that treats him the same way. But
oh my word!
I put the pregnancy. We just got to die our 15-year-old Vietnamese boy. We'd only had him a few months and found out Laura was pregnant. And he asked me, how do you want me to treat her? When I told him, when I picked him up from school. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, you want me to be mean to her? You want me to call her name? And I said, duh. He said, well, that's what my whole family do when my big sister gets pregnant. He said, family, they beat her. They call her name. And I said, Dad, she's still Laura. She's still your little sister or your big sister. And she's still a daughter. I mean, nothing's changed about Laura. She's still who she was, and we still love her. And no, nobody's going to be mean to her. And nobody's going to hit her or call her names. We're very disappointed in her. And somebody told me that Laura told a group. Laura then went on got on her soapbox and was telling the girls, "You get pregnant, the fun and games are over. No more proms, no more staying out late,
no more going, you know, going dating and going with it from this boy and that boy. You have a baby to take care of. You stay at home and you take care of your baby. And I never took care of that baby. People were placing bets on this baby that was going to be because I was a professional mother. And I would keep the baby for her while she had to go do something. And they were living with us. But I never, ever was the mother. Of course, Laura didn't need any help. She'd been taking care of newborns since she was 2 years old. She knew everything to do.
Yeah, it was normal for her.
Oh, yeah, and that's all in the book, too. I didn't leave anything out. That was our family, warts and all. I left out some things that that are very deep, very, very unfortunate. Thank God we don't have anybody on drugs and everybody is a Christian. But there's some personality problems in one of my children. Who has a great job, makes over $100,000 a year, but she's a pain. She's always been a pain, and apparently she's always going to be a pain. But
sounds like some of my kids.
I did not put anything about her in there. In fact, you would hardly find her in the book because she asked not to be in there, except for places where I had to name her and say she was in there, and I think there's one or two pictures of her with babies, but she said she didn't want to have to explain anything because she can't. She didn't like black babies. She did not like that.
It was her personality, and she is who she is. And when you have children, you love them warts and all. It just is.
Yeah. Well, I everything to do with the babies and all the a lot of the bad stuff, you know. I didn't want Daniel, a little white boy with no brain. I didn't want him. I never really felt totally like his mother. I tried really hard, but I already had Ben, and Ben was giving me everything I needed, and I looked at Ben like an angel, and Daniel like a noisy little white boy. I think that's what I said in the book. I told everything like it was. And there'll be people that'll read things that I did and say, oh, gosh, she shouldn't have done that. Oh, that was the totally wrong thing to do. You have to remember the late 70s until 2000. No, 1999.
And until someone walks in your shoes, they cannot judge.
Well,
they have no right to judge because God is the judge.
I have not really had very much judgment thrown at me at all. I really haven't. People usually don't get any further than, dear God, how on earth did you do that? And they just say right there, how did you do that?
You just did it.
I just
did
it. Well,
if you get
God,
if God gave you the strength.
He did. He literally did.
If you get the opportunity.
I look back and I don't know how I did it.
With the help of God. If you get the opportunity to order Dreamcatcher, failure was never an option. And you will see that you and my mother have a lot in common. And
okay.
I will put you on the books for November, and we'll continue this conversation.
Wonderful. I would love that. I just love talking about the babies and knowing people are getting to hear it. I mean, you've done as well tonight. When I heard so many people were listening, I was shocked. And you may as well have sold 10,000 books for me. Because
I hope so.
I'm in this to tell the story. I have virtually no money. I live on my Social Security. I just moved in with my daughter. My life has been just awful, just horrible since my husband died 16 years ago. I've had no money, no resources. I can't work. I have fibromyalgia, mainly from all of the stress from the babies. And I'm doing this to try to be sure that I let as many people know what God did and what God will do if you will go on out into the deep water when you feel him telling you to.
Uh-huh.
It's one thing to stand on the beach and point out there and say, you know, if one of us was to go out there over our heads, Jesus would lift us up. But it's like Peter, you know, if he'd never gotten out of that boat, he probably
exactly.
wouldn't have ever told that story about Jesus walking on the water.
Exactly.
It wouldn't have been personal to him. I call it experiential knowledge. I don't know if I made up a word or not, but that's what it is.
Like
it's
it.
The knowledge, the knowledge of experience.
I know that I know.
Yeah, experiential knowledge. You know, because you've been there. It's like childbirth. You can't
yes.
describe it, but we all, none of us have any trouble. We say, have you had children? Have you had children? Did you have them before they just deadened you as soon as you went into labor? Yeah, I felt having my babies. Yeah, it hurt like nothing I ever felt in my life. We have experiential knowledge of that, and
uh-huh.
nobody can ever tell us it didn't hurt so bad we wanted to die. Nobody
exactly.
can tell us that.
Because if they haven't been there, they don't know.
They don't know. They just don't know.
So on that
Thank
note, my friend.
Thank you so much for having me on.
You're welcome. Thank
yeah.
you, and I'll bring you back in November, and I'll get this up in archives and get you the link, and I'll get the others up in the morning and get you the link, and we'll just get this
Thank
blown out
so
of the water
much.
For you.
Thank you so
you're,
much. God bless you, sweetheart.
You too, darling, and we'll stay in touch, okay?
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right, honey. Bye-bye.